But I strongly resent the idea, you know, that Jesse came forward, decided to, there was a television movie that made that approach, too. One of the strange things, too, I was dismayed that they showed Roswell newspapers. How about showing a front page of the Chicago Daily News, big paper, the front page of the Spokane Chronicle, the front page of the Los Angeles Express, Army captures flying saucer, General thinks it's radar weather gadget. That one had both stories because the cover story came out 6 hours later. And it's more impressive to people. I mean, they say, oh, small town paper, who knows, big deal. They also soft-played, there was a guy named Frank Kaufman mentioned on the show. And Frank was a key witness of, an important witness of Kevin Randall. And, well, it turns out Frank was a fraud. I mean, he faked documents, he did other things. And so they sort of soft-pedaled that, well, maybe now we can't trust him. But Carl Flack had the nerve to say, everybody's, the whole Roswell thing is dependent on Frank. His name isn't even in my book, Crash at Corona, the definitive study of the Roswell incident. It was Kevin Randall's guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I had raised objections, as a matter of fact, to give Frank credit. He died in 2001, last year. And in an interview back in 95, he claimed that he had gone across the mountain to White Sands missile range there and was watching on radar and got a call. He saw a light, something exploded on the screen, and he called over, and somebody at the base is over 100 miles away, looked up north, and there was something had come down up there. So Frank comes traipsing across the mountain, mm-hmm. 100 miles, wakes up Colonel Blanchard in the middle of the night, the base commander of the only atomic bombing group in the world, mind you,
mm-hmm.
And wakes up Major Marcel, the intelligence officer, and they all traipse north to the site away from the debris field that we knew about, in the middle of nowhere, in a military vehicle. They saw the bodies and the wreckage, and they called the base, and a flatbed truck came out, and by morning it was all gone. Now, that made no sense. Colonel Blanchard, as head of the 509, certainly wasn't going to leave his post without knowing what the heck was out there. He'd wait. I mean, if it was one of his B-29s with a nuclear weapon on board, sure.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what's there. And Frank said, well, they didn't have any spotter planes when I asked about that. And I found out they did have spotter planes. In addition, Major Marcel would certainly not have reacted the way he did, sitting at the base on that Sunday, when the sheriff called him to say this cowboy had come in with pieces of strange wreckage and stuff, if he already knew that there was a crash saucer out there. Anyway, it was a lot of elaboration on a story that didn't make any sense. And also, the people that owned the property said there was no way you could get out there in a vehicle until 10 years later. The only way to get there was by horseback. This was 10 miles off the main road, and there are gullies and fences and scorpions and rattlesnakes and, you know,
all the good stuff.
Yeah, and in the middle of the night, you wouldn't do it. And on top of that, anybody who's ever looked at how they handle crashed aircraft knows that you've got to get pictures of the stuff in place, you know, so you get a better handle,
sure,
of what went on. Why is this over there? Which way are the flaps on an airplane or the tail or the landing gears or whatever?
Right, they wouldn't be moving it immediately.
No, what's the point? I mean, you know, so 3 years ago, at a meeting with Frank, at his house, mind you, by invitation, and there were three other people there, he asked me, I mean, I asked him, did you go out with Blanchard? No. Did Marcel go out with you? No. So he admitted he had lied.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly it's a big surprise. I published that in the paper 2 years ago, mind you. So, you know, the story, it could have been a lot worse. It could have been better.
Yeah, and now let me ask you, since you're the premier researcher on this, I think, Anything new developing around this 1947 crash after all these years, or have we pretty well explored everything?
No, one thing I wish they had done on the program was give a number. If you know anything, call this toll-free number, you know. I instigated an Unsolved Mysteries program back in 1989, and it was seen by 28 million people. This one was seen by fewer than 4 million, but we got all kinds of calls from people, most of which were worthless, but some of which were very good. And I'm working now on about 4 stories from people who say, you know, my grandfather told my uncle and me that he saw the bodies, that sort of thing. They did have 2 people on the show, totally new witnesses. One who claims to have seen pictures at Biggs Air Force Base, which was
down in El Paso, right?
Yeah, right outside El Paso.
Mm-hmm.
And the other guy supposedly was at the base, but they didn't spell his name. The first guy was Mo Cox, but the second guy, something like Newley or Newling. I have a list of all the people who were in the base yearbook, and he's not on it, which doesn't prove anything, but, you know, it would be nice if it were.
Yeah.
And so
it proves that maybe he got there too late for the picture.
Well, that one of the people Frank talked about had left the base before the event took place.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are new things going on, and I think that the climate is right for somebody to run a letter, you know, in 1,000 newspapers, anybody who knows anything, please come forward. We're racing the undertaker, you know, and Carl Flock's approach to this is to use character assassination. In his book, he dismisses Colonel Blanchard because he was a loose cannon. You know, the guy had 4 promotions from colonel to 4-star general, mind you.
They wouldn't put a loose cannon in charge of the atomic bomb wing.
Well, yeah, but on top of that, he became Inspector General for the Air Force. He was Vice Chief of Staff. For the Air Force, he was head of operations. That's when he died. He was director of operations for SAC with those multi-megaton bombs under his command. This is a loose cannon? I mean, I have trouble with that. You know, I know there were people who didn't like Butch. I talked to the guy who flew the Enola Gay to drop the first atomic bomb, Tibbetts.
Mm-hmm.
I had him sign a book. He and the Navigator and Bomber were in a roundup, a reunion of the people in Utah. And I asked them about Butch Blanchard, and he didn't like him because General LeMay was almost ready to replace Tibbetts with Blanchard.
Mm-hmm.
So there was rivalry there. But that doesn't mean he was a loose cannon, for God's sakes. And 3 other key people Carl attacks. One of them was a guy named Pappy Henderson, who, after seeing an article in a newspaper in 1980, told his wife that he'd always wanted to tell her, but it was classified. Now it's in the newspaper. He flew some of that wreckage to Wright Field. And he also, she was on the Unsolved Mysteries show, and another buddy of Pappy's called her afterward, and I talked to him, and Pappy had told him the story. Pappy was a squadron commander in World War II, 50 missions over Germany. That's pretty good stuff. And Pappy had shown him a piece of the wreckage. Well, Carl says, well, he was a well-known practical joker, and that was just a piece of a V-2 rocket that he had. Well, I had talked to most of his family. They all knew about the V-2 rocket. I also talked to his World War II bombardier, to whom Pappy had told the story at one of their reunions. He was one of his pallbearers. I mean, they were close. And he had no doubt that Pappy was telling the truth. And Major Marcel, well, he buys into some hokey baloney stuff put out by an East Coast researcher who knows all about government documents but has never been to an archive. And Dr. Rudiak, who did this nice work with the Ramey memo, had shown that his portrayal of Jesse Marcel was nonsense. Just look at the record,
mm-hmm.
You know. And so Carl just buys into it. And so I get a little disgusted when people take all these guys are dead, you understand, so nobody can sue for libel. You can't libel a dead person. That's the way the law is.
Mm-hmm.
You can say almost anything you want, and nobody can sue you, because he doesn't have a reputation to lose, you know, anymore, I guess. So I don't like that kind of attack on stuff. You know, let's... You want to say Frank Kaufman is a fraud? I agree with you. I've been saying it for years.
Mm-hmm.
So the show probably did some good. After all, you don't do a show like that for aficionados like me, you know, people who are involved and so forth. You do it for the general public. And I had a number of people tell me that they found it interesting. They liked Rudiak's work. Now, the archaeology, which was the focus of the show, I thought was pretty worthless. They got 66 lunch bags of dirt that they put in the bank vault.
Yeah.
But they didn't find anything. You know, what did you expect to find in the first place? How do you know you're at the right location? I'll tell you when you're out there. It all looks the same. 10,000 square miles of...
The same. Nothing. Yeah. Nothing.
So and nobody had a GPS on this, you know.
Yes. We're talking with Stanton Friedman, and we're talking about the Roswell incident. How many books total? Just do the two on Roswell, or
I've only done two.
Uh-huh.
There have been at least. Let me see. Phil Klass did one. Cal Corp did one. Carl Flock did one. All published by Prometheus Press. Three anti-books, and then. Sailor did one, somebody else did one, Cherokee did one. There's at least a dozen books out about Roswell, a very varying quality, I might add. And, you know, a lot of armchair theorist stuff, including from the academics, which rather surprised me. I expected them to do a better job.
Expect them to be a little more open-minded?
Yeah, and a little more careful.
Uh-huh.
I mean, one of them, a professor of history at University of Utah, says the only evidence we have, after all, is the three articles in the Roswell paper. What? You know, there were articles, the story grew all day long, and there were articles in much bigger papers because, you know, the press back then, this is pre-television, basically, the press back then would make telephone calls to the town to get the latest scoop, and the Wire would put out several stories in the same day.
Yeah, I'm not quite that old, but I do remember I was still going on when I first got into broadcasting. You know, it just wasn't one little story like they post now on the Internet, and that's it. Back then, it was a continuing work in progress.
All day long.
And I think on our website we do have some other papers posted about UFO, about the Roswell headlines, and one of those was the Chicago Sun-Times, right?
Daily News.
Daily News, okay.
Yeah, front page. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, we're talking right up there. This isn't a little article in the back. But as the day grew longer, these articles got bigger because originally all they had was the press release put out by Walter Hahn. So they ran with that. It went out around noon, New Mexico time, so obviously too late for all the morning papers in the country.
It seems to me that regardless of what the government says, you can't, you know, argue with the fact that they thought out there in New Mexico and Roswell at the Air Force Base that this was important enough to release a press release. I mean,
they were
proud of it, right?
Well, not only to release the press release, but to send a B-29 with Major Marcel and several other people in some of the wreckage that had been brought back the night before, actually, off to Fort Worth on their way to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Mm-hmm. By the time they got to Fort Worth, the fix was in. And the other man in the picture with General Ramey, Colonel Thomas Jefferson Dubose, whom I located and spoke to in person, he was a retired general by then, he told me, standing 3 feet away from me, that he took the call from Ramey's boss, General Clements McMullen in Washington, head of the Strategic Air Command, acting head, actually. The head had other jobs he was doing. McMullen told Dubose, and we have Dubose saying this on tape, which wasn't used, that there were three orders he gave Dubose. They knew each other, all West Pointers here, from McMullen, Dubose, Ramey, and Blanchard, all West Pointers. He told them, I want you to cover that story up, get the media off our back, I don't care how you do it. Two, I want you to send one of your Colonel Couriers up here today with some of that wreckage. And three, I don't want you ever to talk about it again, even with your buddy Roger Ramey. Now, I got this directly from Dubose, who only had 18,000 hours as a pilot and set up the Air Force's search and rescue teams and other little details like that. Prince of a man. And that wasn't mentioned there, but how do you refute somebody like that? He was in his 80s when he said this, of sound mind, I might add.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, West Pointer, that's pretty good credentials. And he was in the room, and he said that that wasn't the real wreckage. And so these are important things. And the Air Force report, I mean, you'd think a newspaper would have wanted a Pulitzer Prize for showing what was wrong with two large Air Force reports. I wrote papers on both of them. You know, this is the Mogul balloon explanation, which doesn't hold up at all as soon as you start looking at it. And then the crash test dummies. I really love those. You know, none of which were dropped until 6 years after the event, and all of which were 6 feet tall and 175 pounds. But that explains the bodies that people remembered in 1947. You know, pretty darn foolish if you want an honest answer to that. But the Air Force got away with it. The New York Times front page Sunday edition, upper left-hand corner. There's no better place for an article, you know, because of the way they stack the papers in the racks on Sunday.
Uh-huh.
60 column inches it went through the inside, buying into the Mogul explanation. Not one bit of effort to talk to any of the people involved with the Roswell incident, but lots talking to the Mogul guys. I mean, this is journalism? And that guy won a Pulitzer Prize for, among other things, showing that there had been secret underground tests that we hadn't heard, nuclear tests that we hadn't heard about. But he bought the Air Force story. So, you know, sometimes it's rather disconcerting when you go through this.
We're talking with Stanton Friedman, and Stanton, here on the UFO Files, I think our audience needs to know what you've been doing recently. And you received a Lifetime Achievement Award recently at Leeds. What's that all about?
Leeds University, 21st Annual International UFO Conference, sponsored by UFO Magazine of England. That's not the American one. And they had invited me to the conference. I've been over there before, and I gave a paper critiquing the Roswell critics. And, you know, it was well-received. It was a good conference, about 650 people there Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday. Saturday night, they had the gala banquet. They were giving out awards for the best video and the best book and so forth. And then, you know, I'm chatting with the people I'm with. There were about 200 people at the gala. And he says, we have one more thing. And I'm looking up, and they turn on their projector, and there's a picture of me at age 3. Which nobody else, of course, recognized,
but I did,
and I'm wondering, what's going on here? And there's a picture of me a little older, and I thought they'd gotten hold of a copy of a program that played on Canadian television, Stanton T. Friedman Is Real, because the first couple pictures were used in that. Then I saw pictures that I knew weren't in there. And so my face is turning red, and I'm wondering, what the heck is going on? And I go up there, and he says, oh, that's not it, and that's not all. And then I found out he had talked to my wife, gotten pictures of me from her, all in secrecy, and he had talked to at least a dozen researchers from all over the world and got them to say nice things about me. I don't know if he bribed them or not. And this is all on video. And so I was awarded the first ever Lifetime Achievement Award they've given out. And there was a conspiracy.
Yes.
And, you know, the funny thing is I went from Chicago to Manchester on a plane and then an hour from Manchester to Leeds in a car with one of the people who knew all about this. He never said a word.
Well, maybe he needs to go to work for the Air Force.
It could be.
Yeah.
It was a nice award. I appreciated it. And on top of it, some guy wrote a bit blurb about each of the lectures afterward, and I got 10 out of 10. Only two of us, the guy I was with from Chicago, did that. So I was well-received. It was a great trip, I'll tell you.
Right. Now, the Stanton T. Friedman Is Real, that Canadian TV show, we've talked about that before. If I remember correctly, there's copies of that available, aren't there?
Yeah, they can get them from me. My toll-free number is 877-457-0233. 3-2, $20, includes shipping and handling, cut off the press, got a nice box, take Visa or MasterCard, and I'll always send along a list of all the other goodies that are available. They're mentioned on my website, too, I think.
We need to give that website address for our radio listeners. We have a link
okay.
on the web, but let's give the website address.
It's www.v-j-enterprises.com/SF for Stanton Friedman page. That's all one word. SF page. .html.
Okay, as I said, we have a link to that too, so people can find that.
If
Can't remember that.
It's a long one.
No, well, then go to jerrypippin.com and click on in fact, this week's shows, and you'll find it. And we also have it under previous guests. I want to take a break, and when we come back here, I want to talk to you about something happening here that involves a huge owl or a meteor or a monster.
Oh, the Flatwoods monster case. Yeah, that's a hot one.
Yeah, I want to find out about that when we come back. Okay, hold on.